both English and Danish and Norwegians and others. Edward was not king of a united island. The far edges of Northumbria remained independent from him, and the submission of the Welsh and the Scots appears to have been a simple matter of tribute payment. But he could claim with justice to be the first king of all the Anglo-Saxons. He had inherited the kingdom of Wessex from his father Alfred, and after the death of his sister had taken control of Mercia as well. With the exception of the Danish kingdom, which remained in the far north, the country that we now think of as England was his. He had decreed, in a reversion to Germanic custom, that his realms be divided between his two elder sons. But one of these sons died a few days after his father. William of Malmesbury, who records the death, gives no details, and the other, Athelstan, became sole king. Like his father and grandfather, Athelstan spent his life in war. He fought rivals for the throne, he fought rebel Anglo-Saxon noblemen who disliked the idea of a single Anglo-Saxon king. He had to reconquer the Welsh and the Scots, who tried to slip from his control, and he mounted a stealth takeover of the Viking holdouts in the northern reaches of the Danelaw. The most vigorous and glorious Athelstan, king of the English, gave his sister in marriage with great ceremony to King Sitric of the Northumbrians, John of Worcester tells us. Sitric, ruler of that persistent Danish kingdom in the north, was already elderly. When he died the following year, Athelstan invaded in his sister's name and claimed the holdout lands in Northumbria for his own. He had brought an end to the Danelaw, and he was well on his way to wiping out the last traces of the independent Anglo-Saxon kingdoms that had once carpeted the island. The task was finally finished in 936, when Athelstan fought a pitched battle in an unknown location, probably somewhere in the northeast of England, against an alliance of Northumbrian Vikings, Anglo-Saxon noblemen, five of whom claim the title of king over their own patches of land, and Scots, led by their long-lived King of Scotland, 60-year-old Constantine II. There, he crushed the resistance to his overlordship. King Athelstan and his brother, the Atheling Edmund, killed five underkings and seven earls, writes John of Worcester, and more blood was shed than hitherto had been shed in any war in England. Author's note, Atheling was the Anglo-Saxon word used to designate a man eligible to inherit the throne. Constantine II of Scotland lost his son in the fight and was forced to flee. The Battle of Brunaburh was so fierce that it earned its own poem in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. Here King Athelstan, leader of warriors, ring-giver of men, and also his brother, the Atheling Edmund, struck lifelong glory in strife round Brunaburh. There the ruler of Northmen, compelled by necessity, was put to flight to ship's prow. With a small troop, never yet in this island was there a greater slaughter. The victory brought all of England firmly under one king for the first time. Alfred the Great had been King of Wessex, Edward the Elder, King of the Anglo-Saxons. Athelstan was now King of England, and had even forced the kings of Wales and Scotland to acknowledge his power. He had lived up to his father and grandfather and moved beyond them. Intent on not disappointing the hopes of his countrymen and falling below their expectations, William of Malmesbury writes, he brought the whole of England entirely under his rule. It had taken over three generations of fighting to pull the struggling English inside a single national border, and that border, straining under the tension, popped open again almost at once. Athelstan, King of all England, died in 939, and was succeeded by his 17-year-old half-brother, Edmund the Just. The Irish King Olaf I of Dublin invaded and took the Midlands of England away, and Edmund was not able to reconquer them until 942, after Olaf died. Edmund ruled his reunified country for barely four more years. In 946 he was killed in a freak encounter. He was presiding over a feast in the honour of St. Augustine, founder of Christianity in England, when he noticed among the guests a thief whom Edmund, sitting in judgment, one of the king's regular duties, had ordered exiled. The sight infuriated him. He stood up and tackled the robber, who drew out a knife and stabbed Edmund in the chest. Edmund's guard came running and hacked the criminal to pieces, but Edmund died within hours. He was 24 years old. He left a five-year-old son, but during the child's minority the crown was taken by Edmund's brother, Edred Weakfoot. The nickname came from Edred's generally poor state of health. Nevertheless, he held the country together, even in the face of a revolt in Northumbria. He almost wiped them out, William of Malmesbury says, and laid waste the whole province with famine and bloodshed. When he died of chronic illness in 955, he passed a unified nation on to his nephew. The new king, Edwy Allfair, was 14, a wanton youth, William tells us, and one who misused his personal beauty and lascivious behaviour. On the very day of his consecration as king, in a very full gathering of the nobles, while serious and immediate affairs of state were under discussion, he burst out of the meeting and sank on a couch into the arms of his boxy. William adds that the English Bishop Dunstan, who was at the meeting, followed his king into the bedchamber, dragged him back out, and together with the Archbishop of Canterbury forced him to give up his mistress and attend to his business. This extraordinarily precocious behaviour is probably a myth, but Edwy did soon make an enemy of both Dunstan and the Archbishop. Raised without a father, he had become a puppet of court officials, who hoped to gain control of the kingdom for themselves. Under their influence, he deprived the monasteries of their tax revenues, destroying the power of the abbots and monks to defy the throne. William of Malmesbury adds indignantly, "Even the convent of Malmesbury, where monks had dwelt for over 270 years, he made into a bawdy house for clerks," which probably explains his dislike of Edwy. Once again, the ghosts of the old Anglo-Saxon kingdoms reared their heads. The Mercian and Northumbrian noblemen, seeing the opportunity to reassert their power against both king and church, decided to throw their weight behind Edwy's younger, easily controlled brother, Edgar. They proclaimed him as rival king to Edwy. In 957, only 2 years after coming to the throne, Edwy lost a battle against his brother and his brother's supporters at Gloucester, and the two divided the kingdom. 14-year-old Edgar ruled north of the Thames, and Edwy, now 16, ruled in the south. In 959, Edwy died at the age of 19, and his brother Edgar became king of all England. Edgar proved more strong-minded than his older sibling. Once on the throne, he took his own road. He restored the monasteries of England, giving the abbots and monks the power to govern their own lands. "They are to have in their court the same liberty and power that I have in my own court," he decreed, "both in pardoning and in punishing." This shrewd legislation at once made all of the abbots and priests in England into king's men, and gave Edgar the backing he needed to reduce the power of his would-be masters. By 973, Edgar was in full control of his country and had extracted oaths of loyalty from the King of the Scots and the King of the Welsh. He had now been on the throne of England for 14 years, but had never actually been crowned. In fact, up until this time, none of the kings of England had gone through a coronation ceremony. Edgar was the fourth king to rule over the entire country, but all of Alfred's descendants, like their great forebear, had reigned as warriors, holding their power only as long as they could hold their swords. But Edgar, in making the church's firm ally, had earned the right to be legitimized by a greater power than the god of war. Dunstan, now Archbishop of Canterbury, created a formal ceremony that would recognize the king's sovereignty, a ceremony that is described in all of the chronicles of Edgar's reign. He was blessed, crowned with the utmost honour and glory, and anointed king in his 30th year at Pentecost, the 2nd May, writes John of Worcester, highlighting the king's age. 30, according to the Gospels, was when Jesus emerged into the public eye as the Son of God. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle remembers the coronation in alliterative Anglo-Saxon verse. Here Edgar, ruler of the English, was consecrated as king in a great assembly. In the ancient town there was great rejoicing, come to all on that blessed day, which children of men named and call Pentecost Day. There was gathered, as I have heard, a pile of priests, a massed multitude of monks. With the church behind him, Edgar sat on the throne as crowned King of England, his country bound together both by battle and by ceremony. 2 years later, he was killed by a swift illness, and his heirs found the crown slipping from their hands. The Northmen were coming, and this time they were under the command of a king. The early history of the peoples north of the Baltic is preserved very imperfectly in heroic sagas. What glimpses we get show a familiar, slow progression from tribal patchwork to unified kingdom. By the middle of the 9th century, the southeastern lands were ruled by Swedish kings from the area known as Uppland, the very southern tip of the Scandinavian peninsula. The islands in the Baltic itself and the peninsula of Jutland were under the control of kings from the peoples known as the Dani. The peninsula's western half, home of the Norse tribes, remained divided and chaotic for longer. Sometime around 870, the rule of the coastal lands known as Vestfold fell to a 10-year-old named Harald. Harald, first with the help of his uncle and regent, and then on his own, began a 70-year campaign to unite the Norse under one crown. Author's note, the exact dates of Harald's reign are unknown, but recent research suggests that he was born around 870 and carried out the bulk of his campaigning during the lifetimes of Alfred the Great and Æthelstan of England. King Harald swore an oath not to cut or comb his hair until he had become sole king of Norway, the epic Egil's saga tells us, and so he was called Harald Tanglehair. In a great sea victory around 900, the Battle of Hæsfjord, Harald Tanglehair defeated the armies of his most dangerous enemies, the Norse princes Thorir Longchin and Kjotvi the Wealthy. This was the last battle King Harald fought in Norway, Egil's saga concludes, for he met no resistance afterwards and gained control of the whole country. It actually took Harald most of his long life to unify Norway under his rule, and even then his control over the country remained shaky and contested. The western Scandinavian lands were chaotic and blood-soaked, and the constant fighting sent more Vikings abroad looking for new homes, more to England, more to Normandy, and quite a few westward to the large island of Iceland, where they joined the small, struggling colonies that had been established there in the 9th century. Harald Tanglehair's personal life did nothing to smooth the troubled waters. His appetite for conquest was matched by his libido, and he fathered between 10 and 20 sons with a variety of wives and mistresses. When he died, probably in the early 940s, the loosely united country again fell apart into a mess of battling noblemen and princes, the noblemen vying for power over their own estates, the princes hoping to establish themselves as the next king of all Norway. Harald's youngest son, Hakon the Good, eventually emerged as the victor, but he had to fight hard to keep the title. His older brother Erik Bloodaxe, who was married to the sister of the Danish king Harald Bluetooth, mounted a 15-year campaign to take the crown away. Erik Bloodaxe himself fell in battle against his brother around 955, but his wolf pack of sons, in alliance with Harald Bluetooth of Denmark, carried on with the civil war. Erik Bloodaxe had earned his nickname from his exploits in battle. Hakon, although just as warlike, was labelled the Good because of his faith. Most Scandinavians still worship the old gods, Odin with his ravens, the warlike Thor with his deadly hammer, and a whole host of others. But Hakon had spent some time as a child at the court of Æthelstan in England, where he learned Christianity. Harald Bluetooth had also become a Christian at some point, but the conversions didn't particularly inconvenience either man. Being a nominal Christian simply made it easier to deal with both the English and the merchants on the continent. To take the sign of the cross, according to Egil's saga, was a common custom then among both merchants and mercenaries who dealt with Christians. Anyone who had taken the sign of the cross could mix freely with both Christians and heathens while keeping the faith that they pleased. But when Hakon the Good finally died on the battlefield, fighting against his nephew, Harald Greycloak, Christianity came strongly to the fore. With the help of Danish troops provided by his uncle Bluetooth, Harald Greycloak, son of Erik Bloodaxe, but himself a convert to the new faith, seized the throne of Norway. He soon proved to be a Christian of a more zealous and driven kind. He could do nothing to make the men of the land Christians, says the 12th century chronicler Snorri Sturluson, but broke down temples and destroyed the sacrifice, and from that got many foes. Unfortunately, Harald Greycloak's sacking of the old places of worship was followed by hard winters, poor crops, and bad fishing. There was great want in the land, chronicler Sturluson writes, and folk lacked everywhere corn and fish. An unnatural cold snap caused snow in midwinter. Harald Greycloak grew more and more unpopular with his people. Resentment grew against him, and this gave his uncle Bluetooth an opportunity. Harald Bluetooth had not supported his nephew's claim to the throne of Norway out of the goodness of his heart. He hoped to add Norway to his own Danish kingdom. As Harald Greycloak grew less popular, Bluetooth plotted with one of his noblemen, Hakon of Hladir, to assassinate the Norse king. Around 976, the plot came to fruition. Greycloak was betrayed and murdered. Harald Bluetooth took the eastern Norse lands for his own, and, for his trouble, awarded Hakon of Hladir control of the upper Norse coast. He did not allow Hakon to take the title of king, though, and so for a time the Danish and Norse lands lay under the control of Harald Bluetooth. He kept firm hold on them with the help of his son and war leader, Svein Forkbeard. For the next decade, Harald Bluetooth's soldiers and explorers ranged south and west, pushing the sphere of his power ever outwards. Danish soldiers attacked the borders of Germany, which was now under the rule of Henry the Fowler's son Otto. More raiding parties went west again to England, where Edgar's 10-year-old son Ethelred had been crowned as king, and the Norseman Eric the Red sailed northwest, pushing Scandinavian power past the island of Iceland to more distant shores. Eric the Red, a troublemaker by nature, had been forced to leave Norway and settle in the Icelandic colonies after a feud with another villager that ended in death. Eric's henchmen, according to the 13th-century saga of Eric the Red, caused a landslide to fall on the man's farm. In 982, he started a brawl with one of his Icelandic neighbours and killed two of the man's sons. The other colonists forced him to leave Iceland, and Eric the Red set sail, searching for a new place to live. After 3 years of exploring, he settled on a massive island 500 miles to the west. There were no people on it, which suited his personality, but he had ambitions to found a new colony there. Thanks to the unusually warm temperatures during Eric's lifetime, the island's shores were partly free from ice, but it was an inhospitable, bare, sandy place. Eric named it Greenland. As his epic notes, people would be attracted there if it had a favourable name. The ruse was successful to a point. Colonists came, although very slowly, building a tiny outpost of Scandinavian power halfway across the North Atlantic. Back home, old Harald Bluetooth died by the sword. His son Svein Forkbeard had hoped that his father would divide his realm and give part of it to Svein, but Harald Bluetooth had not fought for his whole life in order to yield his kingdom to his son. As his father's right-hand man, Svein had ships of his own. He gathered them and challenged Harald Bluetooth for the throne. In a sea battle fought in 987, Harald Bluetooth turned back his son's ships. But in the fighting he was badly wounded. He died just days later, and Svein Forkbeard's followers proclaimed him king. Svein inherited the throne of Denmark, the Danish-controlled lands in Norway, and, theoretically, the loyalty of Hakon of Hladir, ruling the upper coastal lands. With an eye to further expansion, he stepped up the raids on England, and the young English king Ethelred found himself unable to stop them. Scorn for the king who was incapable of protecting his people bursts out from William of Malmesbury's account. Ethelred occupied, rather than ruled, the kingdom, he writes. His life was cruel at the outset, pitiable in mid-course, and disgraceful in its ending. The Danes ravaged Wessex, burned the city of Exeter, pillaged Kent. The death of able-bodied Englishmen in battle and the destruction of crops plunged England into deepening famine and distress. In 991, the East Saxon nobleman Brittnoth, leading a massive attack against the Danish enemy, was killed at Maldon, and his army was routed. Ethelred's advisers suggested that the time had come to pay off the invaders, and following their lead, Ethelred agreed to hand over 10,000 pounds of silver to the Danes. Svein Forkbeard accepted the payment, known as the Danegeld, and withdrew. But Ethelred's solution turned out to be self-defeating. Svein's original intention had been to conquer the island. The chronicler Snorri Sturluson claims that Svein made an oath at his coronation feast that ere 3 years were gone he would go to England with his army and slay King Ethelred and drive him from his land. But he now realized England could be far more useful as a source of income, so Svein had extended his own deadline. It was better to allow Ethelred to pay his expenses than to try and conquer him. In 994, Svein himself returned and fought all the way to London. Once again Ethelred bought him off. But the English king's ability to raise ransom money from his noblemen was almost tapped out, and no one doubted that the Danes would return. In the meantime, Svein used the English cash to fund his conquest of the rest of Norway. Late in 994, Hakon of Hladir died, and control of Upper Norway was claimed by a grandson of old Harald Tanglehair, Olaf Tryggvason. Svein Forkbeard was a formidable enemy, and Olaf's reign was short. In 1000, his warships clashed with Svein's in the western straits of the Baltic at the Battle of Svold. The Norse ships were sunk one by one, and King Olaf found himself standing on the deck of his own flagship, the Long Serpent, surrounded by the dead. So many men on the Serpent were fallen that the railings were empty of men, Sturluson says, and Svein Forkbeard's men began to come aboard on all sides. Olaf leaped overboard and was never seen again. Triumphant, Svein Forkbeard claimed all of Norway for himself. For years it was rumoured that Olaf would return from the depths and free Norway from its Danish overlords. About King Olaf there were afterwards many tales, Sturluson concludes, but he never again came back to his kingdom in Norway. Now in control of both Norway and Denmark, Svein Forkbeard turned back to the English project. Ethelred of England, now in his early 30s, had spent his entire reign so far fighting against Danish invasion. In an attempt to get the Normans on his side against the Danes, their distant relations, he had offered them a powerful alliance. He would marry Emma, sister of Duke Richard the Good of Normandy, if the Normans would provide him with soldiers to help fight off the Danes. For Richard was a valiant prince and all-powerful, writes the chronicler Henry of Huntingdon, while the English king was deeply sensible of his own and his people's weakness, and was under no small alarm at the calamities which seemed impending. Ethelred had already been married once, and had fathered 4 sons, so it wasn't likely that any of Emma's children would ascend to the English throne. Still, the Duke of Normandy liked the idea of an English alliance. It would further prove his independence from the kings of Western Francia. In 1002, Emma travelled to England for the wedding and was crowned Queen of England. But even with Norman reinforcements, Ethelred could not muster a force large enough to turn the Danes away, nor could he raise enough money to buy them off. He was staring defeat and death in the face. Right after the wedding, he flew into a panic and ordered a drastic step. All Danish settlers in England were to be murdered, man, woman, and child. The massacre was carried out in a single day. On November 13th, 1002, the king's men spread throughout the island, slaughtering the Danes in every village. In Oxford, Danish families fled to the church of St. Fridesvide. The soldiers burned it down with them inside. All the Danes who had sprung up in this island, Ethelred later wrote, defending his actions, sprouting like weeds amongst the wheat, were destroyed by a most just extermination. Svein Forkbeard had already determined to conquer England. The massacre lent him the justification of revenge. William of Malmesbury insists that Svein's own sister, who had married an Englishman, was killed on November 13th. This may or may not be true, but without a doubt, relatives of Svein's own soldiers died in the purge, and anger as well as ambition now fueled the Danish attacks. Svein continued to fight a measured, planned war. Over the next 10 years, he sent multiple armies to England. The invasions occupied all of Ethelred's time, killing his soldiers and draining his treasury. The Danes would attack, sack, and burn, accept a payment, and then withdraw. Each time, Ethelred seems to have hoped that the Danegeld would keep them away for good. Each time, they returned. In 1013, Svein Forkbeard himself arrived on the northern coast of England, ready for his final push against the English king. His forces swept southward across the countryside, and the English surrendered, one village at a time. As he approached London, where Ethelred had taken shelter, the Londoners shut their gates. The inhabitants of the town would not submit, the Anglo-Saxon chronicle tells us, but held out against them with full battle because King Ethelred was inside. With the rest of the country in his hands, Svein turned aside from London and went to Bath, the city where the first coronation of an English king had taken place. In Bath, he announced himself King of England and demanded that all the English recognize his title. The city of London, which was the only holdout, had been inspired by Ethelred's presence, but as soon as Svein Forkbeard left for Bath, Ethelred fled to the Isle of Wight, sending his wife Emma and her 2 sons to Normandy to stay with her brother, the Duke Richard the Good. Without their king, the Londoners crumpled. They sent tribute and hostages to Bath, acknowledging the Dane as their ruler. Svein Forkbeard now ruled a North Atlantic empire that stretched across the Baltic and the North Sea. He celebrated Christmas in England as its king. A century and a half after the great army of the Vikings landed on English shores, the island had finally fallen under Scandinavian rule. Chapter 70. The Baptism of the Rus. Between 944 and 988, the Rus fight against the enemies of Constantinople and then attack Constantinople and finally convert to Christianity. The senior emperor, Romanos Lycopenus, was balancing Constantinople carefully on a very narrow spit of political safe ground. The ambitious emirs of the former Abbasid Caliphate were continually driven away from his borders by yearly campaigns, costly in men and money, but crucial for Byzantium's survival. On the other side of the city, the triangle of Western powers, the Rus, the Bulgarians, and the constantly invading Magyars from the north, were kept at bay through a combination of negotiation, threat, and tribute payment, Assuring Constantinople's safety was an exhausting and exacting job, but Romanus had managed it for over 20 years. He was now 74 years old and ruled along with 4 co-emperors. Constantine Porphyrogenitus, son of Leo the Wise, still lived in Romanus's shadow. He was married to Romanus's daughter Elena, and was forced to share the title of emperor not only with Romanus, but also with Romanus's 2 sons and his oldest grandson, all of whom had been crowned as co-emperors. Romanus had arranged the coronations to ensure the succession for his own family, but in 944 his 2 sons, Stephen and Constantine Lecapenus, grew weary of waiting. With the help of their own personal bodyguards, they pulled their elderly father from his throne and put him on a ship headed for a monastery on a desolate island in the Sea of Marmara. This turned out to be only the first act in the drama. Apparently all 4 co-emperors were in on this plot, but Constantine Porphyrogenitus, now 39, diffident and unassertive by nature, had allowed the 2 younger men to carry it out. Stephen and Constantine Lecapenus assumed that this gave them the authority of senior emperors, and Constantine Porphyrogenitus wasn't inclined to argue with them. But their sister, Constantine's wife Elena Lecapenus, did not intend to share imperial power with her brothers. She had been married to Constantine Porphyrogenitus for 26 years, ever since she was 9, and she had grown to adulthood along with her amiable and ambitious husband. She knew he would never grasp the crown for himself. She arranged for her brothers to come to dinner, and convinced her husband to authorize their arrest during the meal. The royal guard seized them as they sat down to eat. Both men, along with Romanus's grandson, the other co-emperor, were put on ships and sent to distant monasteries, suffering the same fate as their father. Constantine Porphyrogenitus was, after nearly 40 years of eclipse, the sole emperor of Constantinople. Romanus would die at his monastery of peaceful old age 3 years later. He had failed to guarantee the crown for his sons, but his dynasty survived. The heir to the throne, Constantine's 7-year-old son, was Romanus's grandson. Constantine Porphyrogenitus began his reign as senior emperor by negotiating a treaty with the Rus. For over 2 centuries, the Empire of Byzantium had turned its battle face east. The armies of Islam had been the single most enduring, most persistent threat to Constantinople. But the Rus, barely civilized in the eyes of Byzantines, were just as anxious as the Arabs to take their turn at besieging the great city by the sea. Less than 30 years earlier, the Arab geographer Ibn Fadlan had traveled up the Volga, through the lands of the Khazars, into the domain of the Rus. His accounts raised the curtain on a people still half wild. Always armed, tattooed from neck to fingertip, living in temporary wooden shelters, copulating in public, and sacrificing to strange, bloody gods. "They are the dirtiest creatures of God," Ibn Fadlan wrote, hardly able to believe the disgustingness of their habits. A slave girl brings each morning early a large vessel with water, and gives the vessel to her master, and he washes his hands and face and hair. Then he blows his nose and spits into the bucket. The girl takes the same vessel to the one who is nearest, and he does just as his neighbor had done. She carries the vessel from one to another, until each of them has blown his nose, spat into, and washed his face and hair in the vessel. Bands of Rus merchants travelled long distances, buying and selling but never bothering to build. To Ibn Fadlan's eye, they were completely transient, leaving nothing behind them, not even burial grounds, since they preferred to burn their dead. By 945, the Rus had grown some visible roots. They had a capital, a prince, and at least the semblance of central government. Igor, Prince of Kiev, had enough power to swear out a treaty on behalf of his people with Constantine Porphyrogenitus. The treaty bound both parties once again to observe the terms laid out in the 911 peace. Rus merchants could enter Constantinople, but they had to be unarmed and in groups of no more than 50 men. If they went back to Kiev peacefully, they would get a month of free food. And if Constantine Porphyrogenitus needed soldiers to keep the Bulgarians or Arabs at bay, the Rus would serve in the Byzantine army as paid mercenaries. The treaty catches the Rus in mid-transformation, partway through the complicated and by now familiar morph from tribal collection into kingdom. Igor's role in negotiating it was king-like, and the terms of the treaty were Byzantine. If a criminal takes refuge in Greece, the Rus shall make complaint to the Christian Empire, and such criminal shall be arrested and returned to the Rus regardless of his protests, reads one article. laying out the sovereign right of each state to execute justice on its own people, and the Rus shall perform the same service for the Greeks. But the Rus who put their names to it, underneath their princes, were 50 war leaders with a mixture of Viking and Slavic names, each boasting the limited authority of a tribal chief. Right after signing the treaty, Igor met the death of a tribal chief. The Rus had conquered the Slavic tribes on the western side of their lands, the Drevlians, 50 years earlier, but the Drevlians had continued to resist their rulers. On his way back from signing the treaty, Igor made a detour through Drevlian territory to collect overdue tribute. He was captured by them, writes Leo the Deacon, tied to tree trunks and torn in two. His wife Olga took over as regent for their son, Sviatoslav. Her first act was to burn the Drevlian city of Koresten to the ground and slaughter hundreds of Drevlians in revolting ways, burning and transfixing and burying them alive. But Olga, too, was changing. Once her warrior queen revenge was finished, she picked up the task of turning the Rus into a state. She divided her realm into administrative districts, pogosts, each one responsible for a set tax payment, and the Drevlians became their own pogost, with regular payments due to the government at Kiev. In 957, Olga made a state visit to Constantinople, where Constantine received her as a fellow sovereign. The floors of the imperial palace were strewn with roses, ivy, myrtle, and rosemary. The walls and ceilings were hung with silken drapes. A choir from the Hagia Sophia sang as she was ushered into the emperor's presence, and mechanical toy lions in the throne room roared in her honor. She was banqueted and entertained for over a week. At the end of her visit, she agreed to be baptized. Constantine's wife Elena stood as her godmother, and Olga of the Kievan Rus was welcomed into the spiritual family of Byzantium. In less than half a century, the Rus had progressed from their wooden shelters by the Volga to the royal reception halls of Constantinople. It was an extraordinarily fast metamorphosis, and it proved to be partly temporary. In 963, Igor's son Sviatoslav took power in his own name at the age of 21. His mother Olga retired from public life and spent her time trying to talk her fellow Rus into accepting Christianity. Her conversion had not brought the entire country within the fold, and Sviatoslav was a throwback. He was an aggressive, war-minded man who rejected his mother's faith. "My retinue would laugh at me," he told Olga when she suggested that he consider baptism. Instead, he followed heathen usages and generally behaved like a tribal chief from earlier times. When Prince Sviatoslav had grown up and matured, he began to collect a numerous and valiant army. Stepping light as a leopard, he undertook many campaigns. Upon his expeditions he carried with him neither wagons nor kettles, and boiled no meat, but cut off small strips of horseflesh, game or beef, and ate it after roasting it on the coals. Nor did he have a tent, but he spread out a horse blanket under him and set his saddle under his head, and all his retinue did likewise. He sent messengers to the other lands announcing his intention to attack them. He spent the first years of his solo rule fighting against the Khazars to his south, the Slavic tribes on the southeast, and the Turkish nomads called Pechangs on his east, as Olga's dream of a Christian people receded. Meanwhile, in Constantinople, Constantine Porphyrogenitus had died in his mid-50s, after a reign of indifference to affairs of state. He was succeeded briefly by his 21-year-old son, Romanos II, grandson of the usurper Romanos Lycopenus. Like his father, Romanos II was amiable and pleasant and easily manipulated. "He was distracted by youthful indulgences," Leo the Deacon explains, "and introduced into the palace people who encouraged him in this behavior. They destroyed the young man's noble character by exposing him to luxury and licentious pleasures and whetting his appetite for unusual passions." The people in question probably refers to his wife Theophano, the beautiful daughter of an innkeeper who had caught his eye when he was 18. For the 4 years of Romanos II's reign, Theophano and the general Nikephoros Phokas, a career officer who had sworn an oath of chastity after his first wife's death and now channeled his energies into conquest, ran the empire. It was a good 4 years for Byzantium. With his nephew, John Tzimiskes, at his side as second in command, Nikephoros Phokas first led the Byzantine navy in recapturing Crete, and then led the Byzantine army in the conquest of Aleppo, retaking territory that had been lost to the Arabs for decades. In March of 963, the same year that Sviatoslav took control of the Rus, Young Romanos II died of a fever. He left his two sons, Basil II, 5, and Constantine VIII, 3, as co-emperors, with the Empress Theophano as regent. Theophano was still in her 20s. She was not enormously popular. She was suspected by Leo the Deacon, among others, of poisoning her husband with hemlock, and she was afraid for herself and her babies. The general Nikephoros Phokas was on his way back to Constantinople after fighting at the Eastern Front, and Theophano sent messengers to him, making private offers of alliance and support. It isn't clear exactly what these offers promised him. Nikephoros Phokas was more than 30 years her senior, and had sworn that awkward oath of chastity. But the Empress's letters inspired Nikephoros Phokas to claim the crown. His army proclaimed him emperor in July, while still on the march, and he arrived at Constantinople in August. The Patriarch agreed to coronate him in the Hagia Sophia in exchange for Nikephoros Phokas's promise that he would never harm either of his toddler co-emperors, and on August 16th he became Nikephoros II, Emperor of Byzantium. In a matter of weeks, he had also married Theophano, which kept her on as empress and made him the stepfather of the heirs to the throne. But although contemporary historians claimed that he was bewitched by her beauty, the marriage was likely a business arrangement. Nikephoros Phokas may well have kept his vow of chastity. Certainly he spent more time on the battlefield over the next few years than in the bedroom. He returned to the Eastern Front and went on fighting the Arabs, while Theophano began a hot and heavy affair with his nephew and chief lieutenant, John Tzimiskes, a dashing officer in his late 30s. Nikephoros Phokas was a lifelong soldier, and now that he was emperor he saw himself not as defender of the faith or chief administrator of the empire, but as supreme commander. He was a man who could not bear to simply maintain his borders. He was compelled to expand them. In 968, he hired Sviatoslav of Kiev and 50,000 Rus mercenaries to fight for him and declared war on Bulgaria. Sviatoslav had just finished reducing the Khazar Empire to rubble, and Bulgaria was the next and nearest big target. Like Nikephoros Phokas, the leader of the Rus was a man who had to fight in order to rule. He marched down to the Danube and launched a shattering attack on the Bulgarians, so shattering that he was able to seize the entire north of the country for himself. Peter I of Bulgaria had a stroke and died, leaving his son Boris II in charge of the remains of the country. Sviatoslav now turned against his employer. He sent a message to Nikephoros Phokas, announcing his intention to march against them and capture their city. He was a talented fighter, but a poor ally. Before Nikephoros Phokas could deal with the threat, he was murdered. He had the soldier's habit of sleeping on the floor instead of his bed when he was in Constantinople, although he tempered this asceticism by spreading a leopard skin and a scarlet felt cloth on the hard stone. On the evening of December 10th, he was sleeping on his leopard skin when his wife Theophano and his nephew John Tzimiskes broke into the room, accompanied by hand-picked members of the royal guard. Leo the Deacon writes, "They surrounded him and leapt at him and kicked him with their feet. When Nikephoros was awakened and propped his head on his elbow, one of the palace guards struck him violently with his sword. And the emperor, in severe pain from the wound, for the sword struck his brow and eyelid, crushing the bone but not injuring the brain, cried out in a very loud voice, 'Help me, O Mother of God!' John, sitting on the imperial bed, ordered them to drag the emperor over to him. When he was dragged over, prostrate and collapsing on the floor, John grabbed hold of his beard and pulled it mercilessly, while his fellow conspirators cruelly and inhumanly smashed his jaws with their sword handles so as to shake loose his teeth and knock them out of the jawbone. When they had their fill of tormenting him, John kicked him in the chest, raised up his sword, and drove it right through the middle of his brain, ordering the others to strike the man too. Nikephoros Phokas had grown unpopular with his people, since his expensive campaigning had forced them into higher and higher tax payments. Within 7 days, John was able to convince the entire city and the Patriarch to crown him as emperor in his uncle's place. At times of great changes in government, usually a lot of unrest and tumult flares up, Leo the Deacon marvels, but good order and deep quiet prevailed over the people, and only the Emperor Nikephoros and one of his bodyguards were killed, no one else receiving so much as a slap in the face. The only other casualty of the coup was Theophano, who had counted on remaining empress. John immediately exiled her to an island in the Sea of Marmara, although he allowed the two boys to remain at court, and instead married one of Constantine Porphyrogenitus's daughters. This allowed him to claim, with some truth, that he, unlike his uncle, was a member of the rightful imperial dynasty. Meanwhile, Sviatoslav of the Rus had threatened Boris II of Bulgaria into an alliance with him, and their combined armies had crossed the Danube and were approaching Constantinople. John Tzimiskes organized a defensive force and marched towards them. The two armies met at Arkadiopolis, 60 miles west of the Byzantine capital, and the Rus were pushed backwards. The Bulgarians, who had not been completely committed to the operation anyway, retreated home. John followed them. He captured Boris II, along with his brother and heir Romanus, and sent the two men back to Constantinople as prisoners. And then he annexed Bulgaria. Sviatoslav fared even worse. On his way back to Kiev, he was ambushed and assassinated by the nomadic Turkish tribe of the Pechangs, who had been his enemies for his entire 28-year rule. The Pechang chief made a gold-overlaid cup out of his skull and passed it around for all of his warriors to drink from. With Sviatoslav dead, his sons fought over the throne of the Rus. The youngest, Vladimir, eventually triumphed, and in 980 he became king of the Rus. 8 years later, after John Tzimiskes died from dysentery and Theophano's sons, Basil II and Constantine VIII, had been crowned co-rulers in Constantinople, Vladimir negotiated a treaty with the two young emperors. The Rus would remain at peace with Constantinople and would supply soldiers for the Byzantine army when needed. In return, he would marry the emperor's sister Anna and convert to Christianity. Anna was not overly pleased with this arrangement. Vladimir was rumored to have over 800 wives and concubines scattered around in various Rus villages, so that he would always have at least one on hand, no matter where he went. But Basil II, as senior emperor, convinced her that she would be doing God's work, since Vladimir would only agree to be baptized if the marriage went through. Anna went to Kherson to meet her new husband, taking her own priests with her, and Vladimir submitted to baptism. "Now you will have her as your wife, inherit the kingdom of God, and be our companion in the faith," Basil II wrote to his new brother-in-law. Vladimir was more interested in the kingdoms of the earth, though, and he saw a monotheistic religion with a strong internal network of priests and scholars as an important part of his country's stability. He had investigated Islam, the Russia Primary Chronicle reports, and rejected it when he learned that he would have to swear off alcohol. He also hadn't been too pleased with the Jewish requirement of circumcision. As soon as he arrived back home, he ordered all his people to follow him into the new faith. When the prince arrived at his capital, he directed that the idol should be overthrown, cut to pieces, and others burned with fire. Thereafter, Vladimir sent heralds throughout the whole city to proclaim that if any inhabitant, rich or poor, did not betake himself to the river, he would risk the prince's displeasure. On the morrow, the prince went forth to the Dnieper with the priests of the princess and those from Kherson, and a countless multitude assembled. They all went into the water. Some stood up to their necks, others to their breasts, and the younger near the bank, some of them holding children in their arms, while the adults waded farther out. The priests stood by and offered prayers. When the people were baptized, they returned each to his own abode. The conversion was a state decision, not an act of faith, and thus too important to leave to individual conviction. Vladimir ordered churches built, created a parish system with priests in charge of different districts throughout the country, and instituted a system of Christian education. He took the children of the best families, the Primary Chronicle says, and sent them for instruction in book learning. The mothers of these children wept bitterly over them, for they were not yet strong in faith, but mourned as for the dead. The old ways were past. Vladimir had wiped out the past and transformed the warrior alliance of the Rus into a state. He had created a new Christian Russia, one that could stand as full ally to Byzantium and take its place as equal to the kingdoms of the West. Part 5. Crusades. Chapter 71. The Holy Roman Emperor. Between 950 and 996, the King of Germany fights for God and chooses a new pope. The family of the Capetians rules in Western Francia, and the peace of God is declared in Christian lands. In 950, an old enemy returned. The Magyars had left the German kingdom alone for over two decades, but now Magyar raids on the south of Germany began again. In 955, a sizable band of Magyars under the command of two warlords named Lel and Bulksu set up camp on the Lechfeld floodplain, just across the river from the city of Augsburg. The Gesta Hungarorum, the national history written 300 years later by the Hungarian cleric Simon of Keza, tells us that they mounted attacks upon the city day and night, raiding the lands around the walls with their light, quick-moving cavalry. Desperate, the people of Augsburg sent messengers to the emperor, urging him to come to the aid of the city. Otto I had already taken note of the increasing Magyar threat. He assembled a heavily armed German cavalry force and marched as swiftly as he could from his court at Ulm to Augsburg. There he fell on them at the third hour during a rainstorm, writes Simon of Keza, swiftly overwhelming the army which was nearer the city. Later stories about the Battle of Lechfeld insisted that only 7 Magyar warriors survived. This is unlikely, but the German attack was absolutely devastating, slaughtering an entire skilled class of Magyar warriors and officers. Lel and Bulksu tried to flee down the Danube in a boat, but German naval forces intercepted the boat, arrested the 2 men, and brought them before Otto. He sentenced them to be hanged like common felons. This broke the back of the Magyar attack. The Magyar alliance stopped in its tracks. Between 955 and the turn of the century, the Magyar settled ever more firmly into the Carpathian Basin, the flat land surrounded by the ring of the Carpathian mountain range. Although they couldn't quite break the habit of raiding their neighbours, they spent more time farming and less time fighting. Christian practices and Christian baptism began to spread into the Magyar community from the outside. The Battle of Lechfeld convinced Otto's subjects, not to mention the historians who chronicled his reign, that he had God on his side. While still on the battlefield, his soldiers hailed him as the God-appointed head of the Christian world. His victory over the heathen Magyars had convinced them that divine favour rested on Otto above all other men. The bloody defeat of the enemy had proved, beyond all doubt, the righteousness of Otto's rule. Otto was already both king of Germany and king of the Italian lands, the first man to hold that particular combination of titles. 4 years earlier, after a nasty fight over the rule of northern Italy, the dukes had invited Otto to take the Iron Crown. Now he was also the saviour of Germany, conqueror of the Magyars. In 962, Pope John XII yielded to the inevitable and crowned him Emperor of the Romans, after the title had lain vacant for nearly 40 years. The title of emperor did not come free. In exchange, the Pope demanded that Otto take an oath. "I will never make laws or rules in regard to things which are under your jurisdiction, or the jurisdiction of the Romans, without your consent," the oath ran, "and I will restore to you all of the lands of St. Peter that shall come into my hands." Those lands were enumerated with careful accuracy: Rome and the land around, Ravenna and its port, the island of Corsica, and dozens of other towns, fortresses, and cities, each one listed by name. The Pope not only governed these lands, but also collected taxes from them. "We confirm your possession of all these things," the oath concluded. "They shall remain in your right and ownership and control, and no one of our successors shall on any pretext take from you any part of the aforesaid provinces, cities, towns, fortresses, villages, dependencies, territories, patrimonies, or taxes, or lessen your authority over them." John XII did not intend to give Otto the sacred imperium unless he could be quite sure that it would not be wielded against him. Otto took the oath in a way. He sent an ambassador to take it on his behalf, which was legally binding but displayed a certain lack of enthusiasm. The circumlocution worried John XII. Despite having just crowned the new emperor, he had serious doubts about Otto's growing power. He decided to take prudent preemptive action. He sent ambassadors to the Magyars, encouraging them to distract Otto from empire building by attacking the Germans once more. Word of this behind-the-scenes negotiation reached Otto. Furious, he marched south towards Rome in 963. When John XII heard that the angry emperor was approaching, he packed up and fled the city, taking much of the treasury with him. This was not calculated to make Otto any happier, and when the emperor arrived in the city, he announced that John had been deposed. On his own authority, he appointed a new pope, Leo VIII. In the past, popes had been given their titles by an undefined and shifting process. The senior priests of Rome would gather together and argue until they came to some agreement about who should be the next leader of the church, and as long as the people of Rome didn't riot, the candidate was publicly proclaimed as the next pope. Although previous emperors of the Romans had also jumped into the fray, offering imperial approval if disagreement over the election threatened to cause trouble, The selection of St. Peter's successor had generally rested firmly within the Christian Church itself. But Otto had now taken this task on his royal and secular shoulders. For him, this was not such a huge departure from ordinary practice. In the kingdoms of Germany and Western Francia, it wasn't unusual for a layman to appoint a priest, a practice called lay investiture. Over the previous centuries, landowners had been accustomed to build private churches on their own estates. It was the Christian version of the old Roman home altar, a reasonable enough action for a Christian Goth or Frank to take, in a world where they were too distant from great cities to make regular visits to the bigger churches or cathedrals built there. These churches were used by villagers and vassals nearby, but the building belonged to the landowner, and he generally chose and installed his own priest to run the services that happened inside. It wasn't uncommon for a father to install a younger son as priest, and for the priesthood itself to become hereditary, passed down for several generations. In the centuries before Otto, bishops and landowners tussled over the control of these churches. By and large, though, they remained under the control of the families who had built them, which meant that the right to appoint a priest could be sold, or given as a gift in exchange for goodwill. A clergyman with money might pay a landowner to make him priest, a practice that church authorities frowned on. It became known as simony, after a New Testament magician named Simon, who tried to buy the divine gift of healing from the disciples of Jesus. Kings built not only churches, but also monasteries on their own royal holdings, and, like noble landowners, appointed priests and abbots to run them, a practice that tended to bleed over into other parts of the country, not just the land specifically held by the king's family. The king, after all, could claim, in a way, to own all of his country, not just his royal estate. Author's note: this is a simplified recounting of the development of a very complicated situation. Under Charlemagne and Louis the Pious, decrees were passed that gave bishops the right to approve any appointments made by laymen. However, this right was exercised very inadequately during the reign of later kings. For useful overviews of this situation, which led to the investiture controversy of the late 11th century, see Ulteranata Blumenthal, The Investiture Controversy. Otto had done his share of building monasteries, appointing abbots and choosing priests. The difference was that he had done it mostly in Germany, where he was king, although even there he and Pope John XII had argued about who had the right to appoint a bishop in several of the German cities. Although Otto was king of Italy as well, Rome was a papal state and not under his jurisdiction, which meant he had no right to appoint a pope. He dealt with the problem by ordering his newly chosen pope, Leo VIII, to make a new proclamation. "We, Leo, bishop, servant of the servants of God," Leo decreed obediently, "with all the clergy and people of Rome, by our apostolic authority, bestow upon Lord Otto I, king of the Germans, and upon his successors in the kingdom of Italy for ever, the right of choosing the successor of the pope, and of ordaining the pope and the archbishops and bishops. They shall receive their investiture and consecration from him." The pope, chosen by the emperor, had completed the circle of power. He had given the emperor the right to choose all future popes. Otto I had now claimed for himself the sole, the only, the inalienable right of the emperor to choose the leader of the Christian Church, and in doing so, he had become more than emperor of the Romans. He had extended his scepter into the realm of the ineffable. He was no longer content simply to surround the church with his soldiers and shield it from harm. He had opened the doors, walked up the aisle, and taken his place in front of the altar. He had become the first holy emperor. Folding sacred duties into the secular job was a two steps forward, one step back sort of process. Otto remained in the city for 3 months. As soon as he left, John XII returned and, with the support of most of Rome, announced that Leo was not the pope and that the decree had been invalid. Otto, who hadn't got too far away, reversed his direction and headed back towards Rome, and once again John fled from the city. This time he never returned. He had a stroke in the village where he had taken refuge. He was rumoured to have been in bed with a married woman at the time, and died, not yet 30 years old. Otto's man Leo was reinstalled with the help of the German army, and when Leo died, Otto exercised his authority as Pope Maker once more, and appointed another hand-chosen pope, John XIII. Once again power pulsed neatly around the closed circle. John XIII, appointed by Otto, agreed to crown Otto's son and heir, Otto II, as co-emperor. guaranteeing a smooth transition of the emperorship. The right to claim the Imperium had never been hereditary before, but Otto was establishing a dynastic claim not just over Germany, but over the less tangible realm of the Holy Roman Empire as well. Both would now be ruled by the Ottonian or Saxon dynasty, which was German and imperial in its claims. The strength of both claims was put to the test over the next decades. When Otto I died in 973, his titles passed at once to his 18-year-old son. Otto II was now king of Germany without election and emperor of the Romans without coronation. Not all of the German nobles were content to see their ancient power of election decaying before their eyes. At once Otto II faced numerous rebellions, particularly in the southern duchies of Germany. The most troublesome of the rebels was his own cousin Henry, Duke of Bavaria, 4 years his senior. Henry's abrasively aggressive personality had earned him the nickname Henry the Quarrelsome, and he saw no reason why he should not lobby to be elected king in Otto II's place. Otto II spent the first 7 years of his reign fighting against these revolts. By 980, he had confirmed, by force, his right to be king of Germany, driving Henry the Quarrelsome into exile and seizing part of Bavaria as a royal possession. He then decided to firm up his claim of emperor of the Romans in the same way. He planned a military campaign into Italy that would drive all remaining Byzantine control off the peninsula, putting it firmly and singly under the Ottoman crown. He would fight for Italy, he declared, under the banner of the Roman Emperor. No longer content to be Emperor of the Romans, as his predecessors had been, an emperor whose subjects were heirs of the remnants of old Roman civilization, he aspired to be Roman Emperor, fully imperial, fully Christian, and fully in control of the old Roman lands. Otto II, says the contemporary chronicler, Dietmar of Merseburg, was noted for his outstanding physical strength, and, as such, tended towards recklessness. His energy and ambition plunged him into enormous trouble. The attempted conquest was a horrendous failure. Otto II fought in Italy for 3 years, repeatedly losing his battles with the Byzantine garrisons still on the peninsula. Southern Italy slipped from his hands as the duchies detached themselves from any allegiance to the northern Italian kingdom. In 983, still claiming to be Roman emperor, still fighting, he grew ill. He died in the city of Rome, not yet 30 years old. He had already declared his 3-year-old son Otto III to be co-emperor, but Otto II himself had barely managed to hold on to the titles transferred to him by his father, and the baby Otto was in no position to insist on his hereditary rights. The Pope declined to recognize him as Roman emperor, and the rebel nobleman Henry the Quarrelsome, skulking around on the northern coast of Germany, laid a plan to get the throne of Germany away from the baby. He insisted that, as the young king's nearest male relative, he should be awarded the care and control of Otto III. This was, in fact, legal. Otto III's mother was in Italy, where her husband had died, so the little boy's temporary guardian, the unsuspicious Archbishop of Cologne, handed the toddler over. At once Henry took the child south into Saxony, where his supporters were gathered. While little Otto was kept in safe seclusion, Henry's cronies began to address him as king and lord. When Easter came, they serenaded him with lauds, the formal songs of praise sung to a monarch. The other noblemen of Germany, unimpressed, insisted that Otto would have to give consent before Henry could call himself king. As Otto was not yet speaking, consent was not exactly easy to determine. Henry suggested that, as guardian, he could speak for Otto and give himself permission to become king, but this proposal was rejected as well. It soon became clear to Henry that if he wanted to become king, he would have to fight for it, and he doubted that he had the strength to resist not just the opposing noblemen in Germany, but also the king of Western Francia, Lothair IV, who had declared himself on Otto's side in the debate. Instead, he began to negotiate a compromise. He would again be given the Duchy of Bavaria, which Otto II had taken away, and in exchange he would hand little Otto back to his mother, who became his regent. With the transfer, Otto III again became king of Germany. The hereditary transfer of power had not been clean, but it had partially succeeded. To the west, though, the hereditary movement of power from one generation to the next suddenly failed. Lothair IV of Western Francia, who had been prepared to fight in defense of Otto III's claim to kingship, died in 986. He left his own crown to his son, Louis the Sluggard. The name, like Henry's, points to a difficult personality. Louis the Sluggard kept the throne for a single year before he died, in all likelihood poisoned by his own exasperated mother. The Dukes of Western Francia, like the Dukes of Germany, now insisted on taking their traditional role in the election of a ruler. The king's family had not done an impressive job of ruling in generations, and the dukes rejected the idea of finding a distant blood relation to elevate. Instead, they crowned a king from a new family, Hugh Capet, son of the Count of Paris, one of their own. The Carolingian dynasty had finally ended in the West. Charles the Great's bloodkin no longer sat on the throne. As the first king of a new dynasty, the Capetians, Hugh Capet ruled an old Frankish kingdom that had lost its eastern expanse to Germany and the southeastern and northwestern territories of Burgundy and Normandy to independence. The lands that remained under the crown were engulfed by multiple currencies, a slew of languages, and a mass of independent-minded Frankish nobles. Hugh Capet had to rule carefully. He had been elected by those noblemen with the tacit understanding that he would not act as a despot. He made Paris his home city, the centre of his government, and began in a very gingerly manner to try to pull Western Francia together into a slightly more coherent country. But his shaky authority was unable to bring peace to his country. Private warfare between French dukes, private oppression of farmers by aristocrats, armed spats between men of different loyalties and languages, dishonest trade, altered weights, Francia was a sea of chaos from border to border. The nightmarish conditions forced the rich to hire personal armies to keep their possessions safe. The poor had no such luxury. Instead, they offered to serve their wealthier neighbours in exchange for protection. This became the root of the later practice of feudalism, the exchange of service, on the part of the poor, for protection and provision from the rich. In 989, Christian priests gathered at the Benedictine Abbey of Charus, in the centre of the Frankish land, and took the problem into their own hands. For Francia to survive, someone had to quench the flames of private war that had followed the disintegration of Frankish royal power.